This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know, there are a lot of kitchen experiments you as an amateur scientist can do at home, for example. Ever shaken a jar of heavy whipping cream till it separates into butter? It's pretty easy. We even do it in kindergarten, right? But it's also kind of mind-blowing, the realization that, hey, you can actually make this stuff, real butter. It's not just something that comes pre-wrapped in the refrigerator aisle. And it tastes a lot better, too. So you walk around the supermarket these days, and you'll see there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff. They're products people used to make themselves, but they don't do that anymore. Here's looking at you, sour cream. My next guest is a ninja of those lost culinary arts, and he's here with a few tricks to get more out of your cooking by doing it yourself. Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, and Good Food. He's out with a new edition with new experiments you're going to want to try. And you can find a few at sciencefriday.com/cookingforgeeks. Jeff, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. If you got any kitchen hacks of your own or needed a little science to improve your made-from-scratch recipes, you can give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Jeff, there's a lot of stuff in your kitchen these days. There's one or two steps removed from the natural state. It's almost there, right? Minimally processed, I'm thinking like vanilla extract. But we've got sort of forgotten how to make all this stuff. When did we lose that ability to make all this stuff?
You know, I think a lot of that happened post-World War II, when we kind of got to two people in the family, both in the workplace, and convenience of buying things from home, and there was that space-age excitement of the modern, you know, go to the store and buy something. And, you know, it's actually kind of amazing how much science contributed to the ability for us to make food. But here we are, you know, 50 years kind of after that point, and we've kind of forgotten some things. So one of the great things I've had fun this last year doing is digging into, well, what happens? How can we do these things ourselves?
How can we make, and vanilla is easy. How do you make the extract?
Vanilla, you can just literally take vanilla bean, slice it open, and drop it into a small jar with a little bit of vodka. Vodka being ethanol is a great solvent, and this is how you make vanilla extract.
People would love to try that.
it's easy, I tell you, especially if you're cooking with the vanilla bean.
Right.
You know, don't throw it away. Drop it in a little small container with some vodka and, you know, put it in the fridge or keep it up for a week or two, and then you'll have vanilla extract.
Yeah, you know, that's great. There's one condiment that people don't use too often, but a really fun project to make, and that is liquid smoke.
Liquid smoke is fascinating. This is one of those ones that demonstrates some really great chemistry. It's made fundamentally by taking whatever your smoke source is, hickory chips, say, putting them inside a container that you then heat, and you take the smoke from that container, a closed container. So we're not talking about combustion. There's no oxygen here. You heat it up, and that smoke you then direct through water, and that water will actually dissolve some of the smoke compounds into it, and it's that water ends up being what we call liquid smoke, and it's got all the flavor compounds. And that begins to give you a little insight that sometimes these things that come in a bottle are actually very simple. Sometimes they're not, though.
Is it safer than actually grilling to get the smoke?
You know, there is some thinking that, in fact, liquid smoke should be safer because a lot of the carcinogenic compounds end up either precipitating out or floating out and not being in suspension inside that liquid.
All right, I can't hold back myself anymore because I'm looking at some wonderful pieces of chocolate and other things that you've brought in.
Chocolate was another one of those fun ones to look into. And who could resist chocolate?
Not me,
so,
that's for sure.
In this case, chocolate, you know, as we think about it, that nice bar of chocolate that, you know, you see Charlie in the Chocolate Factory opening up, goes through a process called conching. And that process was invented in the 1870s by a guy whose last name was Lindt. Quite familiar to those of us who like chocolate these days. And that process really takes the cocoa fat, the cocoa butter, and sugar and really grinds them together in a way. But before Lindt came up with that process, chocolate was unconched. It had this texture that wasn't smooth. It wasn't really for eating. So you can kind of approximate this at home. If you grab some cocoa fat, which is the same thing as cocoa butter, about 30-35% by weight, some cocoa powder, also 30-35% by weight, and the rest sugar, melt the cocoa butter, throw in the cocoa solids, the cocoa powder that is, and the sugar, and mix it up, and you'll get something that looks a bit like that piece that you are looking
this
at.
This round
and
one?
That round one. So,
I am.
So take a bite of it. Now, keep in mind that before we had conching, chocolate was not really a great thing for eating. It was gritty. It didn't have that fine texture. I mean, the flavor is interesting, and it's a fun thing to try.
It's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's not too sweet. Yeah.
Well, in this case, it's because there's not too much sugar in
not
there.
Not too much sugar. And, it's delicious. Let me tell you.
I always know bringing food into the studio is a great thing.
Now, when you see the cocoa content or the you go out and you want to get these bars, let's say 75-80%, what are they talking about?
They're talking about the percent of cocoa product in there, which is a combination of the cocoa fat and the cocoa powder. They're not telling you what the ratio of those two different ingredients. So the other thing that I brought in for you, you see some little white pellets there. Those white pellets are just cocoa fat. I'm going to warn you, they're not particularly delicious. They're not white chocolate. It's just the fat. How would you how would you describe that?
No flavor.
No flavor.
But I can feel the texture of chocolate.
Yeah, it's got the texture.
It's got that mouthfeel.
And the fats in chocolate are actually really fascinating. There's a whole thing about polymorphism, the way they crystallize, the ratios of triglycerides in there. And it's actually somewhat similar to butter, but not quite. So that 70% or 75%, when you see that in the bar, if you've got two different bars that both say 70% from different manufacturers, one might be higher cocoa powder, cocoa solid content. Huh. And then we might have less.
Is there any way to know that when you look at the
You might be able to be clever by backing out the fat concentration. I haven't actually checked that one. I don't think you can really do it realistically, though, at home. Maybe if you had some lab equipment.
And what happens when the chocolate hangs around a long time and it gets a little, like a white film on it?
White film. So that's called blooming. And there's actually two different kinds of blooming that can happen with chocolate. There's either fat blooming or sugar blooming. Most of the time when you see white stuff, it's fat blooming. That's the migration of those cocoa butter, cocoa fat, through the actual solid matter. I mean, if you look at a bar of chocolate, it's actually a really complicated physical structure. Mm-hmm. You've got cocoa solids, which are particulate, suspended inside fat, which, you know, most of us think of that bar as being solid, but the fats in there are a mixture of different triglycerides, and some of those fats are actually liquid at room temperature. Not so much that you notice it, but they do migrate.
But it's not unsafe to eat that.
It's not unsafe to eat. It's just it's going to have a texture that won't be as enjoyable because it impacts the texture. Melt it down or use it in something to cook with. Mm-hmm.
As you know, we love to talk about microbes and fermentation on this show. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about sour cream. Is that fermented? Sour cream is fermented.
Sour cream, that's what makes it sour. It's bacteria. If you know how to make yogurt, you know how to make sour cream. Just use cream instead of milk. Mind blown. It's one of those things where it's like...
My mind is just... It's a mushroom cloud here. can you turn regular cream into sour cream?
Yes.
You take a regular
container of sour cream. The easiest place to get the starter bacteria is from yogurt. So just get some live active cultured yogurt. Throw a teaspoon into the container. Stir it up. And basically let it, quote unquote, go bad. You can let it sit on the counter overnight. If you happen to have a yogurt maker or a slow cooker that's got a yogurt mode, that's better. And that the culture from that yogurt will chow down on the lactose and other stuff that's present in the cream. There shouldn't be too much lactose in cream, but it'll chow down on the stuff in the cream to actually make it into sour cream.
Will it get that gloppy consistency?
It won't get quite as thick as maybe some of the sour cream you're used to, because a lot of commercial stuff sometimes includes thickeners, cornstarch or carrageen or guar gum. But you'll look and go, oh, this is sour cream.
Yeah. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you have questions about food science, which we're talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, Good Food, out with a new edition with new experiments. What new things did you put in the book?
Oh, wow.
Were there things that people asked you for?
Well, there's a lot of different things. The second edition's got over 150 pages of brand new material.
Wow.
So there's a bunch of new interviews with folks like Jacques Pepin, Deborah Madison, Bridget Lancaster, a number of chefs who it was really a pleasure to speak with. There's a whole section, actually, we're talking about fats here. There's a whole section I added in about fats. You know, what are trans fats? How's that compared to what's called a cis fat? What's the breakdown of different fat sources? There's new experiments, so if you've got a middle-aged kid and you want to do a few things in the kitchen, you can do everything from calibrate your oven to calibrating your freezer, just using the physical properties of things like sugar or salt water. It's just, it was so much fun to go back and dig into it.
I'll bet. This really isn't. This is a really interesting section in your book. It's not a do-it-yourself opportunity unless you happen to have a mass spectrometer lying around. But you have a section in the book that talks about how Sherlock Holmes would determine where a tomato was grown.
This one was really fun. You know, we think of water as just being H2O. And right. Maybe if you've got a glass of water, okay, there's some air dissolved in there and maybe some solids, you know, some minerals. But even if you just look at the H2O, there are differences between different molecules. And these are called isotopomers. So if you think about oxygen, you know, it's oxygen 16, as in 8 neutrons and 8 protons. But you can actually have additional neutrons in there. So you can have oxygen 17, oxygen 18, and that'll change, those isotopes will change the actual molecule of water. And those changes change the weight of the water. And that rate, that change in the weight changes the rate of evaporation. So the water that has the heavier isotopes will end up not evaporating as quickly. So if you're in a climate, in an environment where you have a high amount of evaporation, your soil water will skew towards the heavier isotopes. So you can take that tomato and take a sample of the liquid from it and run it through a mass spectrometer and go, okay, wait a second, this is coming from, you know, something that's got this ratio of these isotopomers. And if you look into a bunch of different, you know, factor in about a dozen different trace elements, you can pinpoint pretty accurately where something comes from.
Wow, so you can rule out the tomato came from this part of the world versus it's a warmer climate.
And if you factor in a few of the other things like magnesium or various trace elements, you can begin to get country of origin. It's a huge thing for actually food fraud and food traceability. If you've got honey that's being imported, how do you know where it's coming from?
Wow, let's go to the phones to Savannah, Georgia, one of my favorite cities. To Greg, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
Well, I just want to tell you about some things that I've been doing. I started on a fermentation craze. When I hit, my wife likes to say I didn't buy a sports car. I started fermenting things. And one of the things I've been doing is I used to brew beer years ago, and I started doing it again. And I decided these spent grains ought to be useful for something. So I ground them up, pulverized them, and decided I would substitute a cup of the spent grains in a sourdough bread instead of a cup of the flour. And it's worked out really well.
Wow. Let me get a comment. Let me remind everybody first that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you joined us, we're talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, Good Food. So he's now made double use of his.
That's fantastic and clever, and actually sounds delicious. There's a lot of things with our cooking where we have something that's left over that we then kind of just throw away. We were talking just a few minutes ago about the vanilla extract idea. You've got a vanilla bean left over from making a vanilla custard for the holidays or something. You know, the idea of reusing something is fantastic. You know, apple peels. If you're peeling apples, those peels can be used in a salad, for example. There's lots of cases where you can be clever if you think about the ratio of, like, what is this thing? Is this carbohydrate? Is this protein? Is this, sugar? Like, what is the actual thing you're working with? In the case of the grains that are left over from making the beer, there'll be a fair amount of starches and cellulose and stuff in there that you can use as part of your bread. It'll be a toothier, denser bread, but it'll still taste delicious.
You answered in your book a question I've been wondering about for years, having being a watery person, loving the ocean, having gone around the world seeing salt evaporation ponds. And I would say to myself, hey, I could do this at home. I could just get a cup of water from the ocean and make my own sea salt. But you go, watch out.
You can definitely do it yourself with the sea salt, but you're also going to do it yourself with the mercury, potentially. Because unlike that liquid smoke example where you're actually separating out something, with the do-it-yourself sea salt, you're concentrating everything. There's not a separation process there. It's just a concentration. So anything else that happens to be in the water that doesn't evaporate away is going to be there. So I don't know if I'd want to do it yourself.
No, you talked me out of that one. But you can roll your own oats, it says in the book, right?
This one was fun too. You know, we think about those Quaker oats you might see that are rolled out and flat.
Right.
And you might also have a container of steel-cut oats and not realize that these two things are very closely related. If you get that steel-cut oat wet enough and you flatten it
Tell
out,
me.
You can take the back of a spoon and just press one, and it's going to look like that
Because my wife loves the steel-cut oats, and I like the flat oats, so I can now make one out of the other.
You can try to do it. It's a little bit messy. The starches end up sticking that pressed oat to whatever you rolled out on pretty good. The commercial manufacturing process, a little easier. I think probably in your case, just by two containers.
A little time-consuming.
But still really cool to see where your food comes from, to understand that process and kind of pull back the curtain one layer and go, how is my food being made? How can I make it? How can I dig into the science behind this a bit more?
Anything for the holiday season that you might suggest for us? Some cooking trick? Or I know you always say, and maybe we'll bring this up again, you always say the best thing that you can buy, the number one thing that you can buy in the holidays is what?
Besides a copy of my book.
Besides a copy of, but talking about the thermometer.
Get a probe thermometer.
Yeah,
the number one thing I can tell anybody is get a probe thermometer, because when it comes to something like a holiday roast or something cooking in the oven, it's not about the time. It's about the temperature. So if you take a piece of fish, when I cook salmon, I cook it to 130 degrees Fahrenheit. And I stick a probe thermometer with a long lead, and I set the little unit to go beep, 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 beep when it hits 130. So instead of a timer telling me time to check it, it just tells me when it's done.
There you go. Thank you, Jeff. Good luck with the book. It's great, as always. Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, Good Food. Now in its second edition with a lot of new tips and tricks. Give it a look. He's also a software engineer in his spare time in New York. I don't know when you get that done. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy holidays.
And you too. And did you know that today is National Cookie Day? Just in time for the holidays, we had Jeff on the show last year to talk about his patent-violating cookie recipe. And for the perfect chocolate chip cookie, gooey in the center, crisp on the outside, how do you do it? Well, the secret is up there in our website, sciencefriday.com/chocolate chip cookie. sciencefriday.com/chocolate chip cookie.